I also have to reinstall. Did you
Okay, so let's consider what's called a bipartite system. So we say bipartite when there's two parts. Then any psi for this two-part system can be expressed as where AL and BK are orthonormal bases. Okay. And the coefficients CLK are just complex numbers representing the, which would go into the column vector matrix representation with respect to this basis. Let me give you a definition. A pure state Phi in the composite Hilbert space that can be expressed in the special form Phi equals alpha tensor beta for some states alpha and beta belonging to each of these Hilbert spaces. It's called a product state. It's called a product state, and otherwise, if phi admits no decomposition of this form for some alpha and beta, then it's called entangled. Okay, so an entangled state is necessary but not sufficient. Well, maybe I should skip that. It's necessary to demonstrate non-classical correlations. correlations in what? In the things we see, the outcomes of measurements. Yes. Which we'll come back to. So this is this first discussion of entanglement. We're just going to look at it in the context of pure states. So it's going to be a little bit of a tease. We won't really get into the nitty-gritty until we've developed more formalism. We need to discuss density operators, completely positive maps, things like that, to give a full discussion of entanglement. I'm sorry? An entangled state? Okay, so how do you tell? I mean, notice that when you write down an expression like this, it's basis dependent, right? So I choose some basis, and then I write it out. So for example, you know, this state, if I chose to write it out in this basis, I'll get an expression that looks like this. So the question is, how do you know whether or not there exists some choice of unitary transformation that will express my state such that I can find a clean product state of this form? So how do we tell if the state is entangled? So there's several ways to do that. Because we haven't gone into partial trace and things like that yet, I'll just discuss one such method, and we'll return to this later. So the method I will, so the question is how to tell if some vector psi in HAHB admits a choice of basis such that psi is equal to alpha times beta, where notice there's no sum, there's only one term. Okay, so one way to answer that question is via something called the Schmidt decomposition. So consider the Schmidt decomposition. I'll write it up here. This is a theorem. For any pure state, psi in HA tensor HB we can write psi equals a sum over I lambda I let me call that an n lambda n n a tensor n b for non-negative lambda n that are square summable to 1 and the quantities na and nb are orthonormal bases for HA and HB respectively. Okay, so what's the difference between this expression and the more general expression that follows more trivially from linear algebra? Yeah, there's only one index instead of two. And secondly, the coefficients are non-negative and real instead of complex. Okay, so we'll prove this theorem. Okay, we're going to exploit the fact that the CLKs are a matrix, and we'll apply the singular value decomposition to that matrix and see the consequences of that. So we know that any matrix M in CD cross CD, is that the right notation? Is this the standard notation for a D by D complex matrix? With complex entries. Admits a singular value decomposition. Where D is diagonal, and U and V are unitary. So this means we can consider the Cij as matrix elements of a matrix M, and we can write them out, what did I call them, LK up there? Let me keep the same notation. CLK can be written as a sum over N U L N D N N V N K. So here D N N are the diagonal entries of D. And the standard notation here, lowercase u are the matrix elements of U, and lowercase v are the matrix elements of V. Okay, so this means that we can write the wave function itself out as a sum over LK sum over N U L N D N N V N K L K. And then we can rewrite this as a sum over N, DNN, sum over L, ULN, what did I call it up there? L times a sum over K, V and K, K. So then we'll just define N for system A is the state defined as sum over L, U, L, N, L. And we'll define a state N on system B as sum over K, V and K, K. Okay, so then we have the following form for psi, sum over N, DNN, N on system A, times some state n on system B. Oh, I forgot to say, D is diagonal with non-negative entries directly from the singular value decomposition. Okay, so we've got, now we can check, we can sum over n. Let's just call it dn. I'll call it dnn squared, which is equal to the trace of the matrix D squared, which is equal to the trace, let's insert U, U dagger D, V, V dagger D. Okay, so remember U is unitary, so this is identity. V is unitary, so this is identity. And then we use the cyclic property of the trace. Which is the trace of A, B, C is equal to the trace of B, C, A. As a lemma, and then that means that the sum over N of dnn squared is equal to the trace of m dagger, which is equal to the sum over ij of cij squared, which is equal to 1. Because the state psi is normalized. So, any questions so far? So the last piece is we want to show that the set of states NA and NB are orthonormal. Okay, so the orthonormality of NA and the set of states we've defined as NB follows from the unitarity of U and V. So consider NA prime NA, which is equal to a sum over I prime, UI prime, N prime, complex conjugate, IA prime, times the sum over I, UIN, IA. So the original basis, IA, is orthonormal. I call it L there. Here I'm calling it I. This is just some basis that we expanded. I'm appealing to these definitions here, but I've changed from L to I. Okay, so by orthonormality, we have UIN prime UIN, which basically means we have U dagger U. N prime N, which is equal to delta N prime N. And similarly for B. Okay, that ends the proof. So the Schmidt decomposition, any questions about the proof? All the steps are pretty explicit, I think. So now how is this decomposition useful for characterizing entanglement? Okay, so how is this useful? Well, the point is this is a distinguished basis. So if the state is factorable as per our definition, sorry, another word for product state is a factorable state, so it has two factors. So if the state is a product state, then that means that the Schmidt decomposition will have a single term. Okay? So if psi is unentangled, then does my sum start at 1 or 0? I didn't specify. Where's my Schmidt theorem? Oh, there it is. Yeah, okay, then only one lambda n is non-zero, and in fact it has to be equal to 1 then, because they square sum to 1. More generally, the number of non-zero lambda n is called the Schmidt rank. And this gives some kind of some characterization of the degree of entanglement. It turns out it's not a very good characterization of entanglement, of the degree of entanglement. And we'll see later that I won't get into that. But yeah, it has certain deficiencies as a characterization of entanglement. Okay, so some terminology is that the set of coefficients lambda n are called Schmidt coefficients. And the bases, the orthonormal bases, Na and Nb, are called Schmidt bases.
State which is acceptable has Schmidt rank 1. Maybe it's possible that it's a product state like that, but in the Schmidt decomposition it has two terms or more. Why isn't that possible?
Good question. I think that must depend on the uniqueness of the Schmidt decomposition.
Well, maybe it's unique, but still, just because there exists some in which it, there's some basis in which it's a product. It's not clear to me that the one you get from the singular value decomposition will be that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. How do we see that?
I guess it's the easy one. What's that?
I think it's the easy one.
I can't hear you.
I think SVD is unique.
Yeah, that doesn't answer my question. My question is, even if the SVD is unique, it's not clear to me that the unique decomposition you get is necessarily the one in which a product state will
be. No, I think, but he's saying if the SVD is unique, then an expression of this form is the SVD.
What is that?
Because there's a unique way to write as a single sum over products of states if the SVD is unique, which we should check. So they don't have Google available to them. And or Wikipedia. So if the SVD is unique, then this is a singular value decomposition. So therefore, the fact that it's unentangled implies that we'll have a single term. So that would be the way the argument would go.
I think the coefficients are unique, but the basis doesn't need to be. Well, you can reorder them.
But you can reorder the
constructs. Well, they're not negative. They're non. A local phase, yeah. Does that help?
And I don't think they're going to be moved around because the order in the descending order of the coefficients.
That's a custom, isn't it? It's a convention.
That's just a convention, yeah. So
I guess in that sense, that's what we're talking
about. You guys aren't helping me, huh? The singular values are unique, but not the vectors because of the phase. So, but the fact that the values are unique means that there's only one way to have only one term that's non-zero. Okay, so that means that if the state is unentangled, then your Schmidt decomposition will have this form with one term. Okay, thank you for the question. I learned something. Okay, so just another remark about the Schmidt decomposition. In the special case that we have that the dimension of HA is equal to the dimension of HB, and let's just call that capital N, then a state is called maximally entangled if the Schmidt number is n. And then this property holds for any state that has the form psi equals a sum over n equals 1 to capital N e to the I a n over square root of n n a and B. My normalization right here, so yeah, okay. Sum of squares adds to 1. Perfect.
That's a bit more specific than what you've just remarked, though. It's the same that you switch. Schmidt coefficients are flat. They're all equal in magnitude. You're saying all the Schmidt coefficients are common.
I'm saying any state of this form is maximally entangled because the Schmidt number is n.
But I mean, I can have a state whose Schmidt number is still n, but the spectrum is not flat.
You're asking if that's possible.
Yeah. I could have a full rank diagonal matrix whose diagonal elements add up to the square of them add up to 1, but they're different values.
I have to think about that.
Can you repeat the question?
It's just the way I learned maximally entangled was that all the Schmidt coefficients have the same amplitude, the same magnitude, virtually the same after that phase vector. But just the way that statement is expressed, it mm-hmm. seems that it doesn't matter what they are, provided they are non-zero, and you have n of them.
That's yeah, there might be this might require an additional clause of equal in magnitude. So yeah, let me check that. Let me make note of it so I don't forget.
Can you just scale the vectors though, so that it is?
That breaks off on the mouth, yes.
Yeah, I think you might be right, because if I can just add, you know, some small probability or some large probability of this state mixed with some small probability of some other state,
yeah.
then that would lead, that would not be maximally entangled. It would still have Schmidt rank n. So yeah, so I think that's correct. Okay, so provisionally, let me just, until I verify that if the Schmidt number is n, and all lambda I are the same magnitude.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
With the modulus.
Are they real?
Wait a minute. Why is there a phase here now?
Yeah, it's weird.
The phase, so the phase I think applies to the states. This is a global phase factor, well, for each state. Actually, how is that possible?
I guess it's just an easier way of expressing it so that you don't have to change your basis each time.
Yeah, there's something funny here. There's a relative phase that we can play with where we put it, which makes, all right, obviously I haven't thought about this carefully enough. All right, so let me look into these things, some subtleties here. I'll fix up the notes. I'll be giving you the notes this weekend, and I'll fix it up before I distribute them so we make sure we're not missing anything here. Okay, thank you. All right.
Excuse me, there's another question.
Where? Oh, sorry.
Does the Schmidt decomposition also work if the two Hilbert spaces are not of equal dimension?
Yeah, this expression is true in general.
Because we got a basis NA and NB where little n... Well, it's in the same sum, so it has to run over the same range. That would mean that in both Hilbert spaces, we have an orthonormal basis of the same number of elements, right?
I think the idea is that, in some sense, the sum n can go to the larger of the two Hilbert space dimensions, right? So mm-hmm. suppose Hilbert space A has dimension m, and or let's call it, m, and Hilbert space B has dimension n. And m is smaller than n, then little n would run up to big N so that it covers all of the states for B in principle, but the lambdas would cut off after m. So that's there would only be at most m terms in the sum because there's only m orthonormal states for system A. And then the superfluous ones can't contribute to more entanglement. Anything else? No? Okay, so we'll revisit entanglement. The Schmidt rank is kind of an easy way to characterize entanglement, but it's not, as I mentioned, it's probably not the best way. And we'll look at other ways to do it in terms of entropies later on. Okay, so next I wanted to touch on some aspects of infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, so from wave mechanics, it is convenient to make use of eigenstates for position and momentum. Okay, so we talk about some eigenstate P, which has eigenvalue P. And for position, we have an eigenstate X with eigenvalue X. And then we write inner products between these things. So X P is equal to this normalization and then we have X is a Dirac delta function, which is a distribution function, and P prime, whoops, all right, and we call this here, this will be called psi p of x. So we're expressing kind of the momentum eigenstate and the position basis, so to speak. Okay. But now recall, the infinite dimensional Hilbert space is L2R, which is square integral functions, and any element of L2R must satisfy that the integral over dx from minus infinity to infinity psi of x squared is equal to 1. Well, strictly speaking, it has to be less than infinity. It doesn't have to be 1, but we then normalize it to 1. But if we apply this to psi p of x, this is equal to e to the I p of x minus x. With some normalization factor, which is equal to minus infinity to infinity of dx times 1, which is, of course, which does not converge, which is infinite. Okay, so we see that the familiar plane waves of wave mechanics don't actually fit into our Hilbert space framework. But we use them anyways, and so we need some way to justify that. Peggy, do you have the notes printed out? Okay, so there are two solutions to this problem. Okay, so the first solution is Dirac's approach. Okay, so what Dirac does is he breaks the Hilbert space formalism. And he uses something called the rigged Hilbert space. So, which is based on something called the Gelfand triplet. Which basically allows us to include functions which are not in L2R, but we restrict the set that we include such that they satisfy an inner product with a subset called a nuclear space, which is a subset of the Hilbert space. And I won't go into the details, but suffice to say that when you break the Hilbert space picture and enlarge it to this rigged Hilbert space picture, then that allows, in this space, the Dirac delta function and the plane wave are allowed in this larger scenario. And in this scenario, we can define a spectral decomposition for position, which has this form. Notice that for a bounded self-adjoint operator acting on L2R, we always have a discrete spectrum, so we're always summing over basis elements. But now, because we're going to this larger structure called the rigged Hilbert space, we're allowed to have continuous spectral decompositions. And similarly for the momentum. And in this rigged Hilbert space picture, we also have a spectral decomposition for the identity. I'm missing something here. This should have an X, sorry. Okay, so here this is a projector and this is a scalar. And the resolution of identity, you can do it in terms of X or P. So the point is, we can recover these elements of wave mechanics that we use to solve problems, but it's important to understand that they don't actually fit in the Hilbert space picture. We have to change our framework. But we don't have to, but well, yeah, we have to if we want to talk about these vectors. Okay, so in this setting, we also have to define the Born rule. And the Born rule becomes the probability that X the probability that x is in some interval a, b, so the position coordinate can be expressed as the trace of the integral from a to b of x times psi psi, which then is equal to the integral from a to b of dx psi x squared, which is the rule you're familiar with.
There's no x, it's just x.
Yeah, thank you. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's right, thanks. Okay, and we also define, these are all analogs of what you would get in the regular Hilbert space picture. If you have some function of the operator x, you can just write it as df f of x. Okay, so this might make you think, any questions about this? Here we're just recovering what you kind of know and just showing that it fits in a certain mathematical structure. Unfortunately, you know, we'd like to have some kind of elegant formulation of quantum mechanics, and this isn't very elegant because we're saying, well, maybe you need Hilbert space, maybe you need some more general structure. So it turns out it's possible to accommodate the position and momentum operators without breaking the Hilbert space formalism. So we can keep our picture that everything's happening in Hilbert space via von Neumann's approach. So the other approach to this problem requires a little more, well, quite a bit more mathematical machinery. So von Neumann's approach, it preserves the Hilbert space structure. For infinite dimensional systems, okay, so now it's always a judgment call about how heavily we want to get into this, but okay, let me just start defining it. I mean, how many of you guys are like math wonks and really want to see how this works? About a third? All right, well, that makes it a tough decision for me, maybe a bit more than that. Well, we'll see how, I'll ask that question again in 10 minutes, all right? So we'll see how far we get. Okay, so how do we do this? We need to describe operator-valued measures. So let's start by talking about A as a linear operator. On some infinite dimensional Hilbert space H, then the domain of A which we'll denote as just D of A is the set of all psi such that A psi is an allowed element of the Hilbert space. So now we're going to assume that A is densely defined on H. Okay, what that means is that there's an element of the domain of A that's arbitrarily close to any vector in the Hilbert space. Now we can define the adjoint of A as follows. That satisfies two conditions. One, say that the domain A, some operator, which we call adjoint of A, some operator is the adjoint of A if this, if the domain of that operator is all phi in the Hilbert space for which there exists some other vector eta satisfying it's T. This is weird. All right, T psi okay. So I don't, T isn't defined.
I think the T should be A.
Yeah, I think you're right. A acting on the dual vector, right.
So when you say A is a linear operator on H, actually you are defining A on a dense subset of H,
mm-hmm.
not a whole of H, such that for every psi on H, you have some sequence on the domain that A applied to the sequence is going to converge to that particular psi. Is that what you mean? Like you take any psi on H,
mm-hmm.
in principle, A of psi is not well defined, right? You're only defining A on
yeah.
a dense subset.
Right.
But so it means that you can also find a sequence that converges to this psi. And belongs to the domain.
Right.
Such that A applied to the sequence converges to A applied to something which you call A to psi. That's
yeah.
basically.
Okay, and the second condition is that A dagger acting on phi is equal to eta, where eta is the unique vector. Satisfying A psi phi is equal to psi eta for every psi in the domain of A. Correct my typo. Okay, so now we can talk about what the adjoint of an operator is in infinite dimensional Hilbert space using this technical overhead. And once we've done that, yeah.
Could you please write what we call grid letters, bit logic? Like I can barely distinguish.
Oh, my cursive?
Yeah. Like
oh, I
eta
see.
And phi. I can now distinguish this eta and.
Eta and phi?
It's very similar in both.
I'll try to write bigger, maybe. I don't really want to change notation, but I'll try and write bigger. OK, so then now we've defined an adjoint. we can define a self-adjoint operator is one such that A is Hermitian, and two, the domain of A is equal to the domain of its adjoint. Okay, so in finite dimensional Hilbert space, these issues of domain don't really occur because all vectors in the Hilbert space are elements of the domain. All right, so the full vector space is the domain of every kind of linear operator acting on it. But in the case of infinite dimensions, we have a stronger condition. We have the Hermitian condition, which is often in textbooks treated as equivalent to self-adjointness, but it's actually weaker. For infinite dimensions, we demand that it's Hermitian, which is basically that the off-diagonal elements are the complex conjugate of, you know, like the upper and the lower triangles, and we have to have this condition on the domains as well. So self-adjoint implies Hermitian, but Hermitian does not imply self-adjoint.
So what is the definition of Hermitian?
Hermitian means that A phi psi is equal to phi A psi for every psi and phi in the domain of A. And I didn't write bigger here, so this is A phi psi phi A psi. I guess I should put hats everywhere. Okay, so what's an example of an operator that's a not self-adjoint? So as an example, the momentum operator minus I d by dx on the Hilbert space H equals L2AB. So we're looking at some interval on the real line, not the full real line. So it's when you have a particle in a box, for example. So we're constrained geometrically to some finite region. Then the momentum operator is not self-adjoint. But it is Hermitian. So it has domain problems. Okay, but P and X on the usual Hilbert space, which includes the full real line, are self-adjoint.
For this first example here, can you give an example of an element of the Hilbert space which is in DA but not DA dagger?
No.
If you're claiming the domains are equal, then there should be an element of one that's not in the other, right?
Yeah.
So what's an example?
So there's an example in terms of D by DX. So in this case.
Yeah, but you're saying the domains are equal, so there should be an element in the space which is not in the.
No, I'm saying it's not self-adjoint.
Yeah.
Because it fails this condition.
Sure. Exactly.
So it means that there is an element in one of the domains, which
yes.
is not in the
what's
other.
What's an example of such an element?
Do I have that written out? No, I don't know if I can reproduce the argument from memory, but if you look at, if you go to a functional analysis book and you look at d by dx on this Hilbert space, there's examples of states which for which the adjoint of P does not have the same domain as P itself.
But so okay, is the domain of P the whole Hilbert space, all of H?
No.
Why not?
Well, remember, our condition is square integrability. So all you need is a function which is let's see if I can remember this example. Did you have a comment?
I have just a question.
Oh, well, let me just see if I can remember this example of
do you require that the wave functions are zero on at A and B, the elements of the Hilbert space?
I don't know. I don't know that we need to require that.
Maybe you do need it to vanish at the boundary.
For
it to be remission, yeah.
Oh, is that right? Maybe. Okay, so I'll have to check my notes. I do have an example written out somewhere, and I can look that up for you. Because, I don't remember off the top of my head. Yeah.
How do you define the derivative operator on the space? Is it a weak derivative? In principle, functions in L2 are not even continuous. How do you differentiate?
You're asking how to define a derivative operator on a function?
Because L2 space is not a space of functions, right? It's a space of equivalence classes.
Right.
So, in principle, you don't need to have any kind of continuity. How is this derivative like a weak derivative? Or, how do you define it?
I think I've seen that, but I don't know the subtlety there. I mean, can't you always impose the equivalence class after the fact? Just include every element as distinct and only later say, okay, well, this class is equivalent. Like, take the derivative before imposing the equivalence class condition. So then you have continuity.
No.
For L2, we don't require continuity, do we?
I was saying before you impose the equivalence class condition.
Continuity and integrability, they have nothing to do with each other. So in principle, you don't need to have any kind of property of differentiability.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
I think
have an assignment problem for the weekend, which is to look up the different definitions of differentiability for equivalence classes, and let us know on Monday.
Well, there is one. If you instead of using L2, you use like the first of all that space, which includes the weak derivatives.
Well, are you using L2?
Then I don't know.
Well, that's what you're going to find out this weekend. All right, you'll report back on Monday.
I think I have an example. So I think you actually, if you want P to be Hermitian, you need to restrict H to functions that vanish at endpoints, so the boundary term goes away.
Why is that?
So the boundary term goes away. It'll be Hermitian. Because we do integration by parts.
Yeah,
the boundary.
You can twist the derivative on the other function.
I mean, you need the boundary term to go away when it's on R, not on a subinterval of R.
So when you try to prove that P is Hermitian, you want P to be Hermitian, you have to use integration by parts. And then for inner product to be the same, you need the boundary term to be zero. That will require the function vanishing at the endpoints.
Okay, that sounds plausible.
Now consider a function like a sinusoid, which is zero on endpoints. If you apply P in the derivative, you get like a cosine, which is no longer zero at endpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be in the Hilbert space.
Demand.
Yeah.
Okay, that might be it.
I think
that sounds good.
An example.
It's not the example I remember, but it sounds like another example. All right. Well, you guys are interested in this technical business. Good. Do I have any boards left? No. All right, so I'm not going to be able to finish this today, so it's a good start. Well, let me just go a little bit further. Okay, so with all these definitions in hand, we can now define a generalized spectral decomposition. So for each self-adjoint operator A, so this is due to von Neumann, 1932. There exists a one-parameter family of commuting self-adjoint operators, self-adjoint projection operators, E lambda with lambda an element of R satisfying condition one, E lambda prime is greater than or equal to E lambda, or lambda prime greater than or equal to lambda. So lambda is our real parameter. Two is that in the limit as epsilon goes to zero from the right, E lambda plus epsilon goes to E lambda. The third condition is similarly going to infinity. Going to minus infinity, E lambda converges to zero. And lastly, in the limit that lambda goes to positive infinity, this operator, this projector E lambda projects onto the entire Hilbert space. Okay, so this allows us to write the generalized spectral decomposition of some self-adjoint operator A, which will include the position and momentum operators in this form. Where lambda is a scalar, and we've defined a operator valued measure DE. Okay, so how do we deal with this kind of an object? I'll go over here. Okay, so the way we evaluate something like this is if we have an expression of the form of standard Dirac notation, we have this operator A, and these are elements of an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, then we can evaluate this expression in terms of the properties 1 through 4. And in particular, we can define this as d mu phi psi of lambda. I guess I should drop the lambda. So this operator valued measure dE induces a standard measure through its action through this inner product. So I assume most of you aren't familiar with measure theory, which is too much of a digression to get into, but it's a way of generalizing the notion of probability theory to deal with continuous sets. And then we can use something like this can be defined as a Lebesgue integral. So it's a way of defining integration. The non-Riemannian notion of integration based on measures is what would be appealed to here. So we have some terminology. A projection-valued measure a projector value measure, all people often just call it a PVM, refers to the spectral family E-lambda. Okay, so now we recover a notion of Born's rule under von Neumann's approach for self-adjoint operators. And it's the probability of lambda. So here, think of lambda, the one parameter, think of it as the eigenvalue of the position and momentum operator. So we're doing this to accommodate the position and momentum operators, which are unbounded but self-adjoint operators. And so they each have a parameter. So for position, it's x. For momentum, it's p. And the one parameter family is exactly indexed by the eigenvalue x or p. So think of that as the probability that x is in some interval, the probability that p is in some interval, is then evaluated as follows. Integral from a to b of lambda. Sorry, no, there's no lambda. D. E lambda psi.
Question?
Yeah.
So the if I think about this integral that you wrote down in the second line on that blackboard over there, can we think it's an integral over the real line? So whatever this d measure is, I can just apply a chain rule, right? Crudely speaking, I can just write d whatever over d lambda times d lambda. Or over dt times dt. So I can just think about this effective integration just as a scalar product or whatever with a wave function. Is that true? Because we had a course before on distributions, and then we had these wave functions and integration. So does this measure imply a wave function in that sense?
I don't know what you mean by implies a wave function.
If you think about, you have this integral over r lambda times d measure, and then this is something, okay, I guess it give us a number in the end. So you can think about this as just applying the chain rule, because you're on the real line, you can reparameterize your integral. So you just go d whatever over dt, right? And then you just have a real integral over dt, and then this derivative that you have is basically the wave function. I mean, that would intuitively explain why you're all of a sudden you can have functions that don't decay at infinity, because now you have that wave function that makes everything finite.
Mm-hmm. I think that's over. First of all, there's two wave functions in this problem. This is an inner product.
Yeah.
So that's the first issue with that approach. And the second is that this is a complex number. So it's actually you can write the complex number as a plus ib, so you have a dA times a dB. So I think that might be oversimplifying things. Well, I actually have an example of how to use this. So why don't we go through that, and that might help clarify.
I have a quick question too.
Yeah.
The number one here, what exactly do you mean by E lambda prime is greater than E lambda?
Oh, so in general, when we say some operator A is greater than some operator B, there's a nice way to express that, which is psi of A minus B is greater than or equal to 0 for every psi in the Hilbert space. Actually, I guess greater than 0. Okay, so think about the difference operator. Take its evaluate its expectation value, and that's what that means.
Okay.
So it basically means the difference operator has positive eigenvalues if it's diagonalizable.
But you can only make this definition on operators as a positive spectrum. Otherwise, you can't compare it to zero. Like if A has complex eigenvalues, then you can't say.
Right. So we're dealing right.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
this
yeah.
would only be true if A and B are
okay.
have positive spectrum. That's true.
Okay.
Which is the case here because these are projection operators. Actually, yeah, that's a good point. If you have in general, if you have complex numbers, this is even well defined.
Yeah.
So similarly, if you have operators with a complex spectrum, this is not a well defined notion. But let me give you the example so it gives you some more practical way to understand these kind of unfamiliar expressions, okay? So we'll go a little bit long, I guess. Or, you know, maybe it's better. I'll let you digest this, and then we'll give the example at the beginning of the next class. It's already late, so let's do it that way. Okay, thanks for asking so many great questions today. I'm learning some things that I haven't thought about in a long time. So have a good weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.